The Pentagon loves nice, round numbers.
14. More or less.
14?
14.
Million?
Yeah.
What did you say, General?
Billion.
$14 billion for designing one armored vehicle.
That's one way of looking at it.
It's the same old cliche. Just shop until you drop it.
There's a little movie based on a true story of the military's little spending problems. Now, you might say the Secretary of Defense these days wants to produce a low-budget sequel, indie war movies at the Pentagon, trying to keep it under $500 billion, more or less. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, April 7th. I'm John Hockenberry. Adora Udoji is away spending time with her new baby. Coming up this hour, we'll discuss President Obama's visit to Istanbul, Turkey. We'll also hear about rescue efforts in Italy, and we'll take a closer look at the cuts in next year's defense budget. Shop till you drop? Well, Robert Gates doesn't want that to happen. Those stories coming up, but first these headlines. Death count from an earthquake in central Italy is rising. Italian Premier Silvio Berlusconi says it's now over 200 and that rescue efforts will continue for another 48 hours. The 6.3 quake struck early yesterday, leveling entire blocks. U.S. Special Envoy Richard Holbrooke is in Pakistan today, where he's defending military strategy for the region. He says the U.S. is responding to the region's particular challenges.
It takes time to do this. It takes time to learn it. We're anxious to share that. And we're very comprehensively moving in that direction.
That statement comes after the first visit by American officials since the Obama administration laid out its new strategy for the region last month. Mark Garrison, what else is out there?
Thank you, John. President Obama spent his last day abroad talking to college students at a town hall meeting in Istanbul. He told them not to always believe the stereotypes of Americans they see on TV.
Sometimes it suggests that America has become selfish and crass, or that we don't care about the world beyond us. And I am here to tell you that that's not the country that I know, and it's not the country that I love.
The president is leaving Turkey. He'll be back in Washington tonight. The North Carolina Tar Heels claimed victory over the Michigan State Spartans in men's college basketball championship last night. UNC forward Deion Thompson said they weren't nervous of the Detroit crowd.
We definitely did a great job with taking the crowd out and not even allowing them to be a factor to give Michigan State a little bit of juice to play.
Yeah, that was humiliating.
Yeah, big win, 89-72. The women play tonight for the championship. That's UConn versus Louisville.
So the Dow fell 0.5% yesterday to finish at 79.76. The S&P fell 0.8% to close at 8.35. And both the Dow Jones Industrial Futures and the S&P Futures are down this morning. There will be a negative opening on Wall Street when Wall Street opens in about 90 minutes from now. So I have a cold. You can hear it. I'm not contagious, Mark, so don't worry. But I need some remedies. Tell me yours.
Stay back.
877-8-MY-TAKE. He's walking quietly away out of the studio. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We're also talking about the science of itching on the program. What itch do you need scratched, literally or figuratively, at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Perhaps it's safe to call Barack Obama's eight-day trip to Europe triumphant. He's in the last day of it. It's his second full day of visiting Turkey, and he's in Istanbul this morning, where Asli Aydintaşbaş, a journalist and former Ankara bureau chief of the newspaper Sabah, joins us. Also, Jeff McAllister, who's a BBC political commentator and former bureau chief in London for Time magazine, joins us from London. Jeff, thanks for being with us.
Nice to be here.
And Asli Aydintaşbaş, this is a really interesting moment Barack Obama is receiving a lot of emotional responses from the people in the street of Istanbul, but there's a nuance here. It seems to me that Washington likes to view Turkey as some sort of moderate bridge nation. Do Turks see their nation in the same way?
Well, it is true that typically Turks don't like being just a symbol of a moderate nation or a symbol of a corridor between East and West, you name it. But in this case, I have to say, Barack Obama did several things here. He didn't just talk about Turkey as a Muslim nation or a moderate Islamic country and whatnot. He really also spoke to secularist Turks who do not like to be labeled Islamic only. He made a lot of references to Turkey's secular traditions, secular history, paid a trip to the Atatürk Mausoleum, the founder of modern Turkey, and sort of seen the figure who's seen as the founder of secular Turkey. And in fact, in several references, particularly in his speech in the parliament, he talked about secularism. So when he's just about leaving right now, I think, and we have the situation that he's pretty much pleased everybody. I mean, Islamists are happy because Turkey's greater role in the Muslim world and greater role as a regional power is highlighted. Secularists are happy. Kurds are happy because he's met the leader of the opposition. Minorities, Christian minorities, are happy because he made a reference to the need to open up the theological seminary, Greek Orthodox seminary. And Armenians are happy because although he has made it pretty clear that he would not be using genocide, this sort of the word genocide, in his speech to on the Armenian issue this year. This is a hot topic in Turkey. But he's also, urged Turkish Parliament in his speech yesterday to come to grips with its own past and normalize relations with Armenia. So we're in this funny situation here in Istanbul, completely in love with Obama, and he said something nice to everybody, and I don't know how it happens.
Happiness, happiness, happiness. It sounds just dreadfully boring.
We drank the Kool-Aid.
Yes, indeed. Jeff McAllister, you know a bit more about these things than I do, but it seems to me the typical ritual for a new American president on dealing with the Middle East, and, you know, let me just say as a caveat, Istanbul is in Europe geographically, but nevertheless, the overtures to the Islamic world and to the Middle East typically begin in places like Israel or Saudi Arabia for new American presidents, not on the streets of, an enormously diverse country like Turkey. Is Obama breaking the rules here?
I think he is, and obviously deliberately so. I mean, he made his first interesting move with the Islamic world when he did his first interview, television interview as president to an Arab news channel. He also gave the New Year's wishes to Iran, which got a tremendous amount of attention in Iran, and he very carefully called it the Islamic Republic of Iran when he's referring to it, in order to signal that regime change is no longer a goal of the United States. And now he, of course, 11% of Americans think he is Muslim. He has a Muslim name, and he's taking advantage of the opportunity that he has, being this quite unusual figure, to go out to the streets and try to shuffle the deck in a different way with America's relations with the Islamic world.
Well, how far does this go, Asla? Is this a honeymoon period, and are there expectations and strong, concrete ones from the people of Turkey and broadly in the Muslim world that are going to have to end up being deliverables, or does this just kind of fade away and after a while this just becomes another American president?
And I'm not very cynical by nature, so I'd like to see the glass half full in this case, because it is true that expectations are really high here, and it would be impossible for any politician in any country to kind of meet all of it. I mean, when Obama was elected the 44th president of the United States in November, a tribal leader from southeastern Turkey sacrificed 44 sheep in his honor with banners that says, "Obama, one of us," obviously obviously he's not one of us. He's the President of the United States, and he's going to continue representing U.S. Foreign policy. But this change in tenor, I think, is very important. You know, I think it's sometimes I look back at the speeches President Bush has made while he was here, and he'd made similar overtures and references, but not. And it's clearly, you know, you can take it's clearly not what was said, but who said it in this case. So Bush has never had this kind of impact, although he's, you know, made a good many gestures to Turkey. There was this morning in Istanbul, he was at a historic location holding a townhouse meeting with a bunch of students, and one of the questions, Turks are typically cynical people, and one of the like most Middle Eastern, you know, like most Middle Easterners, and one of the questions was like, okay, you know, you are a different person and a different pace, but it is like, does it essentially mean a different policy? And how are you going to be? Are you really going to be different from George Bush? And he took that question very, very seriously, saying, you know, I know what you're asking. I know you're just saying, am I just a new face? But I'd like to think I have different policies too. And then went on to talk about his differences, including, you know, Iraq war and climate change and whatnot, issues such as that. So I think that you know, how much of it is this sort of personality and symbol that Barack Obama has become for Turks and Muslims and else, rest of the world, and how much of it is actual content of what he said? It's actually difficult to say, but
right.
Very
best case scenario, Asla, you know, George W. Bush would only have gotten 43 sheep there in eastern Turkey. Jeff McAllister, is there a fundamental contradiction between this almost symbolic and very emotional sense of wanting America through a persona like Barack Obama to lead the world, and this also knee-jerk sense that America needs to get out of the way and stop lecturing to the world at the same time that characterized the Bush era? It feels contradictory to me.
Well, that's the interesting thing. I think Obama managed to thread this needle extremely well. I mean, especially because of the economic crisis that most people think was made in America, you would have thought he might have had a harder time on this trip. But in fact, he has said, "Look, I'm open for business again diplomatically. I want the United States to be active," and in fact, countries want the United States to be active. With the United States not at the center of the world system, it's like the gravity turned off. And although people do resent it if the U.S. throws its weight around too much, he's managed to appear humble enough, interested enough in other people's opinions, able to sort of take in new views. I mean, this is something that Obama has done his whole life. He's been extremely skilled at being a good listener from the time he was a little kid in Indonesia to Harvard Law Review and there on. I think he managed to not only look like he knows what he wants to do, but look young, vital, beautiful wife. He has all the newspaper people that gave him applause after his press conference at the G20. You don't see that
right.
Very often.
So, before we go then to both of you, what's the tantalizing next step that you think is potentially possible here, either in policy terms or just symbolically? Asla, you first, and then Jeff.
Well, I mean, at some point we'd have to get to the substance, and that would be, I think, some movement in the Israeli-Palestinian front. And I know that's very difficult with the local election with the election results in Israel and whatnot, but at least something on the Syrian-Israeli track that seems more doable, and Turkey has been moving
right
forward on that issue.
No, and Turkey's been involved, and also there have been
there.
Right, and there have been some interesting details there. Jeff, tantalizing next step, and then we'll go.
I agree about the Israeli one being interesting and tantalizing, but very difficult. I think Iran does have a possibility of regional conference, some kind of progressive steps of getting them enmeshed in the negotiating system and in the
right
worldview that we'd like them to take on.
Well, fascinating conversation. Jeff McAllister, BBC political commentator, former bureau chief in London for Time, and Asla Aden Tashbash, journalist and former Ankara bureau chief of the newspaper Sabah. We leave you with Barack Obama.
I came here out of my respect to Turkey's democracy and culture, and my belief that Turkey plays a critically important role in the region and in the world. And I came to Turkey because I'm deeply committed to rebuilding a relationship between the United States and the people of the Muslim world.
Istanbul.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. You know, you can hear it in my voice. Sometimes we need to rely on our listeners for more than just opinions and takes on the news. We need to rely on them for cold remedies.
This is Mitchell from Chicago. Hey, John, you have a cold? Don't try any homeopathic remedies. They're not medically approved. Don't waste your money.
That'll produce some controversy. 877-8-MY-TAKE, your remedies at mytake@thetakeaway.org. We've already had a few. So President Obama is pressing for Turkey's inclusion in the European Union as part of his visit. But the role of Muslims in European countries right now is the issue of a heated debate. And nowhere is that debate more heated than in the Netherlands, where an increasing Muslim population has caused a populist backlash and a string of high-profile murders in recent years. People in the streets of Istanbul may be describing Barack Obama as their president, and it was certainly an emotional day in Turkey. Here is Barack Obama speaking.
Moving forward towards Turkish membership in the EU would be an important signal of your commitment to this agenda and ensure that we continue to anchor Turkey firmly in Europe.
Anchoring Turkey in Europe, Barack Obama addressing the Turkish parliament on Monday this week, yesterday. It's part of a very emotional visit by Barack Obama to Turkey, the once center of the Islamic world, but no longer. It's a secular state that is trying to get membership in the European Union. Frans Timmerman joins us now. He's in the studio. He's the Dutch minister for European affairs, and he's here in the United States on I gather it's sort of fortuitous that you are here. But first of all, you're watching all of these pictures of Barack Obama first in Europe, taking Europe by storm, and then in Istanbul, which very much wants to be officially a part of Europe. What do you make of it?
Well, first of all, the election of Barack Obama had more attention in the Netherlands than our own election. So people are really excited about this, also in the Netherlands. And Europeans were apparently waiting for something to change in America. America's back, and we're so happy that America's back, and we want to build our future in coordination with the Americans, because only with them we can solve the big problems we're facing.
Now, it's not a new U.S. position to call for Turkish membership in the EU, but is Barack Obama making so much of this on a very public visit to Istanbul and Ankara? Does that inflame tensions within the EU or just annoy people like Sarkozy, who says, leave it to us in France?
Well, of course, it's up to the EU to decide, but at the same time, you know, just imagine the possibilities of a Turkish EU membership and Turkey becoming a full-fledged European member state. That would send a strong signal to the rest of the world, saying that you can be a Muslim state and still be a democracy, still have the rule of law, still be a full-fledged member of the EU. That would change the world, frankly.
Now, Netherlands is not an Islamic state, but you have firsthand experience with the limits of tolerance and the sort of tension between secularism and religious communities, even inside the Netherlands. Explain how the Netherlands are, in some sense, an object lesson in learning tolerance for a European nation.
Well, through the ages, it's a bit like New York. There was never a minority big enough to dominate other minorities. So we were always a state of minorities, different religions, etc. Now, recently, we've become a state with a big majority, as we see them, the Dutch, and then a new minority, the Muslims, Moroccans mainly and Turks. And we're struggling with that because many people in the Netherlands feel threatened by this new minority, feel that they need to adapt better to Dutch society, this new minority. But at the same time, we're creating increasing successes, especially the youngest generation is bursting through in education. One out of four is going to university. And so I think our traditional system of tolerance is working.
Although there are politicians in the Netherlands who have openly called for expulsion or strict controls or mandated assimilation of Muslims. Geert Wilders, for instance, is one. How do you deal with that in an open democracy where people can share their views, even if they are hateful?
Well, the biggest problem we're facing now all across Europe is that large parts of our population do not believe in progress anymore. They think that they've reached the pinnacle and it's all downhill from here. In that context, any newcomer is seen as a threat to positions of existing communities. And we have to convince people that there is an opportunity here, that people like Barack Obama can change the world if we join him in his program. If we do that, we can get people to be more open to newcomers in society.
Has there been a backlash to the openness of and welcomingness of immigrants in the Netherlands? I'm thinking of the death of Theo van Gogh, who was a filmmaker who was very openly critical of certain ethnic communities, ran afoul of Islamists inside the country, that produced all kinds of tensions that are still resonating inside the Netherlands.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's quite clear that many people in the Netherlands, people who do not have an agenda, are still afraid of the Islam, afraid that the Islam will impose its rule on the Netherlands. And this, of course, has a political implication. People then choose for xenophobic politicians. And it is difficult for us to argue that at the end of the day, society will have to cope with newcomers and will have to allow new religions to find their way in our society.
Of course, Islam is hardly a new religion. But does the admission of Turkey into the EU inflame those tensions, or does it release those tensions?
It inflames those tensions because people have the idea that the EU has been enlarging too rapidly as it is, and that allowing a country like Turkey with more than 50 million people in would change the balance in the EU and would even lessen our span of control over what's happening in the EU. And indeed, the Islam has been in our country for centuries, but Wahhabist Islam is something completely new.
Well, talking about what Barack Obama has set in motion in Europe, I'm speaking with Frans Timmermans, who is a Dutch minister for European affairs. He's right here in the studio. We're going to take a break for headlines and then continue our discussion with Mr. Timmermans. Mark Garrison.
Thank you, John. It's 28 minutes after the hour. A top American commander and a diplomat are in Pakistan today. Special Envoy Richard Holbrooke and Joint Chiefs Chair Admiral Mike Mullen are talking to local leaders about the fight against militants. This is the first visit by American officials since President Obama announced a new strategy for Afghanistan and Pakistan. The White House wants a stronger crackdown by Pakistan's government on Taliban militants there. Pakistan's northwest area along the Afghan border is a stronghold for militant activity. Part of the administration's plan includes new funds for Pakistan, but the government has to meet anti-terror goals to get the money. Holbrooke and Mullen also visited Afghanistan. More than 200 are dead in the powerful earthquake that devastated part of central Italy yesterday. 15 are still missing and more than 1,000 people injured. The 6.3 quake struck about 60 miles northeast of Rome. Rescue workers had to scramble for cover again this morning when a strong 4.9 magnitude aftershock hit. They've reportedly pulled more than 100 people alive from the rubble. Officials say they're surveying the damage by helicopter and that rescue efforts will continue for another 2 days. After that, chances for survival for people trapped are lower. Vermont Governor Jim Douglas has vetoed a bill that would legalize same-sex marriage in the state. The state legislature overwhelmingly passed the bill in March, and it's already lining up a vote to overturn the governor's veto. The Vermont House of Representatives, though, needs 5 more votes than it had in March to secure an override. Finally, a U.S. district judge is expected to dismiss corruption charges, or the conviction, rather, against former Alaska Senator Ted Stevens today. Attorney General Eric Holder requested the case be dismissed after charges of prosecutorial misconduct. John.
Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
The Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Sitting in for John Hockenberry. I'm Fred Hockenberry. Actually, I'm just John Hockenberry with a cold. Your remedies, please, 8778, my take. This is no drill. This is an emergency. My take at thetakeaway.org. We're fortunate to have Frans Timmermans, the Dutch Minister for European Affairs, in our studio, continuing our discussion of really the historic visit of Barack Obama to Europe and now to Turkey, which wants to join Europe, not geographically, but as a member of the European Union. Let's talk for a moment about the reception that Barack Obama has gotten. I think we romanticize Barack Obama as a kind of Kennedy figure. I think, you know, there's a predisposition after 8 years of Bush and the frustrations of the post 9/11 era to think everything's fine now. But it does seem to me unmistakably that Europeans and people on the streets of Turkey are predisposed to some kind of serious change. Why do you think that is? And from the European perspective, let me share that, please, with you.
Yes. Well, John, this is so exciting to see that our people are reacting so clearly to President Obama. But there's two sides to this. There's one side that says this is change. America's going to change. They're going to be back on the international scene. They're going to work with us, which is positive, and that's what people are reacting to. There's another side to this that's far more difficult. This means that we can no longer hide. You know, we have to step up to the plate, we as Europeans. We can no longer blame Bush for everything and not take responsibility.
But this is a moment when America's credibility economically is probably at a nadir. This is a moment where militarily the U.S. can do relatively little, and Iraq demonstrates that. Afghanistan, who knows how that will turn out, but some here in the United States have called that Barack Obama's potential Vietnam. How can Barack Obama be such a change agent at a moment of American challenges?
You know, what excites people is that we're back on the page of values. We're talking about values now, and we have discredited our own values in the last 8 years. Guantanamo Bay has taken away our own values, has made us look at ourselves in a dark light. And I think what really excites us now is that Barack Obama is prepared to go back to fundamental values and start from there. That's why we're so optimistic. That's why we really want to be part of this new era.
And so when Barack Obama says we have to bring Turkey into the EU, unlike George W. Bush, he's not lecturing to Europeans?
Well, he will be seen, certainly in some countries, as lecturing to the Europeans. And at the end of the day, it's Europeans themselves who have to decide on this. But I think it is important that he joins his voice in this discussion, because he can tell us as well how importantly internationally, how important for the international relations Turkish EU membership would be, the strong signal it would send to the Muslim world.
So finally, I want to talk about this for a bit, because a couple of my favorite books are on the Dutch heritage here in the United
yes.
States. Simon Schama's Embarrassment of Riches,
yes.
which is all about how the Dutch people almost accidentally, culturally stumbled into this incredible wealth of mercantile capitalism centuries ago, and how that was part of the founding of Manhattan. Here
exactly.
in New York, a tradition of mercantile capitalism mm-hmm. and tolerance that we retain today. Do you see that Dutch heritage in America's financial troubles? We almost destroyed Wall Street, something the Dutch created in a way.
Well, you know, the financial capitalism can deteriorate into greed. And we saw it in the 17th century in the Netherlands as well. You had the tulip bulb trade, which actually was exactly the same thing that happened now on Wall Street.
One of the most famous financial bubbles of all time.
Absolutely. You know, one tulip bulb was worth more than a huge house on an Amsterdam canal. Exactly the same thing happened in the financial markets then. So,
any tulips in your portfolio today?
No tulips in my portfolio. But, you know, again here, we're back at the issue of values. If you do not base what you do on your moral standards and on values, this is what will happen every time again. This, when you say that greed is good, like Gordon Gekko, that's when things go wrong. And we did this at some point in the 17th century. It happened again in the last couple of years. So we need to go back to our basic values.
Does Europe lead in that, or is that an American leadership role? And what do we make of the Chinese, who are actually lending money to everyone at this point?
I think the only way we can create leadership is by having a transatlantic bond on this. I think Europe and the U.S. can lead on this together. Jointly, we can really change things. On our own, we will certainly not be in a position to change things. So I think if we rekindle this fundamental value of democracy, the rule of law, of respecting people's choices, of giving people opportunity, I think this should be the basis of our new world.
What is the message from you and the Dutch government to the most irredentist, perhaps fearful Dutch citizen about the emergence of Islam in a Europe with Turkey as a full member of the EU?
Well, my message would be, look in our past, look at what we've achieved through the ages by being open towards everything that is different, by being open to newcomers, by being a safe haven in the 17th century for all those who were persecuted in the rest of Europe. That is how my country came into being. That is how my country was strongest ever in history, and that is how my country will build its future again.
And, of course, you've kept the water at bay, too.
Absolutely. And so, this is something we want to share with New York, because it's great to live on the water's edge.
Good skill to have, building dikes in a time of climate change. Hell of a job there in the Netherlands. Frans Timmermans, Dutch Minister for European Affairs, here in the studio. Frans is on a trip here in the United States to celebrate New York's 400th anniversary, which the Dutch can take full credit for. Thank you, Frans. And now Mark Garrison has some headlines.
Thank you, John. It is 22 minutes before the hour, rather. President Obama is on his way back to the U.S., after ending his first overseas trip as president in Turkey. Earlier this morning, he spoke to a town hall of Turkish college students. He told them a U.S. partnership with the Muslim world should go beyond battling terrorism.
I came here out of my respect to Turkey's democracy and culture, and my belief that Turkey plays a critically important role in the region and in the world. And I came to Turkey because I'm deeply committed to rebuilding a relationship between the United States and the people of the Muslim world.
Air Force One took off just a little while ago. The president arrives in Washington tonight. A man authorities believe stole a plane in Canada and took it on a wild ride through the U.S. is now in custody. The military scrambled F-16s to intercept it, and Wisconsin even evacuated its state capitol building, fearing an attack. A state trooper said the man was apparently hoping to commit suicide by forcing the military to shoot him down. The small four-seater went missing from a Canadian flight school yesterday afternoon. It actually finally landed in Missouri about 6 hours after it was reported stolen. It only had about 8 hours of fuel in it. Then the state authorities picked him up once he landed.
So it wasn't a sleeper cell?
Not a sleeper cell. No. A cell of one, when the target was himself, apparently, is what they're talking about. So also new information in the investigation into salmonella and pistachios. The Food and Drug Administration has found traces of the bacteria in critical areas of a California plant. This is at the Seton Company. That's the one that's been under suspicion. It recalled 2 million pounds of nuts last week as the probe heated up. Now it's expanding the recall to all of the nuts from 2008. And the FDA warns consumers to avoid eating pistachios or any products with pistachios in them until the feds can trace where any of the tainted nuts may have gone. They could be in ice cream, cake mix, cookies, trail mix. Seton, it's the largest, second largest, rather, pistachio processor in the U.S., so a wave of product recalls could be coming. Finally, in college basketball, the women's NCAA championship game is tonight. Connecticut takes on Louisville. Connecticut is undefeated, been beating teams by double-digit margin, so it's going to be a challenge for Louisville, what we will see. Of course, on the men's side last night, the North Carolina Tar Heels took the championship, crushed Michigan State 89-72 before Michigan State technically in East Lansing, but they were in Detroit. So it's about as close to a hometown crowd you can get for a championship game.
If Louisville in the women's game can stay in that game against UConn, it will be pretty dramatic.
We'll see.
Otherwise,
you
a blowout.
You never know what happens.
Otherwise, a blowout. Thank you, Mark Garrison.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Today, a Peruvian court hands down its verdict in the trial of former President Alberto Fujimori on charges of human rights abuses. It's a long-awaited verdict and an interesting look at a democratically elected leader of a Latin American country who is facing charges of human rights abuses. We're joined by the BBC's James Painter, Latin American analyst for the BBC's World Service from Bush House in London. James Painter, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
How important is it for the Peruvians to look back at the Fujimori era, and will this settle anything?
Well, I think certainly the human rights groups and the victims of the abuses during the period 1900 to 2000, when Alberto Fujimori was president and fighting a brutal war against the Maoist guerrilla group Sendero Luminoso, they will want to see some sort of justice for the crimes that were committed. Whether it will, in the longer term, make Peruvians more at terms with their past, I think, is a different question.
How is this different from a human rights allegation treated in, say, Chile or Argentina? It really is set apart how the Peruvians have handled this from typical kinds of, you know, truth and reconciliation forums, if I might sort of coin a phrase from South Africa, in the past.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. As I think you mentioned, it's the significance of this is it's the first time a democratically elected president has had to face charges of human rights abuses in Latin America in his own country. You may remember General Augusto Pinochet in Chile avoided trial on health grounds and was never had to face the court for human rights violations. In Argentina, at least two former military presidents involved in the dirty war against left-wing groups in the 70s were convicted of human rights abuses, but they were military presidents. And if you remember, they had lost the war with the UK over the Falklands Malvinas, and there was a very different political context. So this is really breaking new ground that a democratically elected president is facing these charges.
And the charges are responsibility for two death squad massacres, which killed 25 people, 30 years in prison if convicted, and Mr. Fujimori is already serving a six-year sentence for a separate trial on abuse of power, more of a political dispute, which was settled in 2007. Describe how people publicly viewed this trial. It was televised.
Yes, no, it was extraordinary that it was televised widely in Peru. But I think the really interesting aspect to this is that Fujimori still has significant support within Peru. Many people remember him fondly and with affection for doing two things. One was bringing inflation under control. When he came to power in 1990, it was upwards of 10,000% inflation. The economy was in a complete mess. And the second thing is that he and his army and police were responsible for defeating Sendero Luminoso, which at the time in the 1990s threatened at one point to take state power.
So made him extraordinarily popular. I mean, nobody believed that Sendero could be brought down.
That's absolutely right. And it was largely due to the capture of its leader, Abimael Guzman, that Sendero was beaten. But Fujimori definitely had an important role to play. So there are actually in Lima at the moment, there are counter demonstrations. There are demonstrations led by his daughter, who might well stand and become the next president of Peru in 2011, in support of Fujimori, saying this trial is a political manipulation.
Well, at the very least, it may set the boundaries, the parameters for being president of a Latin American nation. Certainly it has relevance in Peru. BBC's James Painter, Latin American analyst for the BBC World Service, joining us from Bush House. Thank you so much.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Wither the Pentagon's $500 billion budget. In just a moment, right after headlines from Mark Garrison.
Thanks, John. 12 minutes before the hour, the death count from an earthquake in central Italy is rising. Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi says it's now more than 200 and that rescue efforts will continue for another 48 hours. The 6.3 quake struck early yesterday, wiping out whole city blocks in some cases. U.S. Special Envoy Richard Holbrooke is in Pakistan today, where he's defending military strategy for the region. Yesterday, Pakistani leaders told him the country needs, quote, unconditional support if it's going to successfully conquer militants in the area. A federal judge today is expected to throw out the conviction and indictment of former Alaska Senator Ted Stevens. That's after a request from the Obama Justice Department. Prosecutors failed to turn over notes of a crucial interview where a prosecution witness contradicted a statement he made later under oath. Stevens, of course, lost his reelection bid just days after his conviction. John.
Thank you, Mark Garrison. So, oh gosh, my voice is getting worse. So where are those cold remedies, folks? 8778-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We referred to this at the top of the hour, suggesting that perhaps the theme of the Pentagon's procurement tactics in developing new weapons could be a song with the title Shop Till You Drop. But here's Robert Gates talking about a new Pentagon budget and a very new way of looking at buying in the Pentagon.
We must rebalance this department's programs in order to institutionalize and finance our capabilities to fight the wars we are in today and the scenarios we are most likely to face in the years ahead, while at the same time providing a hedge against other risks and contingencies.
He's the Secretary of Defense for now, but Robert Gates' news conference yesterday was sort of interesting for its theatrics as well as its mathematics, outlining a new policy for the Pentagon. Robert Gates is taking on business as usual at the Pentagon, a very serious challenge. And joining us to talk about it is Paul Hughes, former Army colonel and senior program officer at the Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention, and Elizabeth Boomiller, reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Both join us from the Washington, D.C. area. And Elizabeth, good morning to you. What are the numbers that people really need to take away here?
Good morning. That is a very good question. What's interesting is that while this is a broad reordering of strategy for the Pentagon, of the weapons it buys and the weapons it doesn't buy and the weapons system it kills, the Defense Secretary did not give an overall net number of how much he was reducing the Pentagon budget, which is well over $500 billion. And so it is unclear exactly whether this will be enough to offset the $25 to $50 billion in the gap between defense programs and the funding for them. Nonetheless, he did make some major decisions. For instance, he said the Pentagon will stop production of the F-22 fighter jet at 187. That means only four more will be built. There will be, for a temporary time, only 10 aircraft carriers instead of 11. Some of these big defense weapon systems on which a lot of the defense contracting industry depends are going to be cut or stopped entirely. And one last thing, he's going to stop production of the new helicopters for the president, the Marine One helicopters, and basically start all over again, a very controversial decision for a program that had a lot of delays and serious cost overruns.
Paul Hughes, is the message here for the generals in the Pentagon, or is the message here for the congressmen and senators who depend so much on the politics of having defense plants and defense industries in their states and districts?
I think it's much broader than that. Not only are the politicians that have to worry about constituent votes in their districts and home states are concerned, but the generals are concerned because some of them now have lost their items that they have been attached to for quite some time in terms of job assignments, program developments, and things like that. But more broadly, it's a warning to the rest of the federal government that they need to become partners in this new vision of national security for America. The civilian capacities that have lagged behind for so many years and have really cost the troops on the ground a lot of blood and treasure need to step up and need to be funded and developed.
Now, Donald Rumsfeld famously tried to radically transform the procurement strategies in the Pentagon and failed miserably and left in disgrace, in a sense. He didn't have much respect for the men in uniform. How is Gates going to be any different here?
Well, Gates is taking on the military's advice. There are some in the military that have long felt that there has been too much emphasis put on legacy systems from the Cold War, such as the F-22. And, you know, he and Admiral Mullen are sitting at the top of the strategic pyramid in the Pentagon, and they have to make some very hard calls to adjust to the realities of the day's wars, but also prepare for the wars of the future. And so there's this sense of risk-taking and hedging that they have to calculate into their strategic designs. You know, they have to set the strategic goals of America, they have to provide the resources, and they have to organize the forces that are sent out to attain these tasks.
Well, the job description is clear to me. Elizabeth Boomiller, I guess the question is, what are the tactics that Robert Gates can use? And maybe he's just a fall guy here who's going to do the hard work in news conferences like this, and Barack Obama gets to step away and worry about his next nominee for defense secretary.
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, I think, first of all, I think the Secretary Gates is going to stay longer than the year that was widely assumed he would stay. I mean, he, in his first press conference after he was reappointed by President Obama, he said, "I am not going to be a lame duck secretary." And this certainly reflects that, because by proposing this kind of a budget, he is, he's got to carry it through for at least some time. I would say several years. That's what the betting is now, that he might say 3 years. And also, don't forget, he's a Republican. He's routinely described by members of both parties as a non-ideological pragmatist, and he's worked for, I should say, 8 presidents of both parties. So, you know, he will say privately, I know how to do this, I know how to adapt. And it's quite clear he's been thinking about this for some time and just saw this as an opportunity. The other thing I would add is that Senator Carl Levin, who's chairman of the Armed Services Committee in the Senate, told reporters last week that he thought that what Gaetz was doing was quite politically brilliant, because by announcing his budget recommendations before they go to the White House, they always leak out in pieces in previous years. He, as you suggested, is taking something of a hit for Obama,
right?
Because as a Republican, he can absorb this. And again, it's Gaetz's recommendations, not the president, who wants to do this.
Well, there's so much to talk about here. Paul Hughes, I'm going to give you the last word. One of the details in the report yesterday was the F-35 aircraft is going to be leapfrogged into development. Is this a military decision, or is it more of a stimulus package where we're going to be selling that plane to other nations and creating jobs with it?
Well, it's a little bit of both. The F-35, I think, is a more relevant airframe to today's tasks than the F-22. Certainly in Iraq, I never had much use for an F-22. But there's always this inherent tension between, you know, providing for the national defense and pursuing it, and then establishing a jobs program. And a balance needs to be struck, and I think Gaetz is trying to do that right now between those two demands.
Well, Paul Hughes, we're going to have to leave it there, but fascinating stuff watching the numbers and the strategy and tactics of Robert Gaetz at the Pentagon. Paul Hughes is a former Army colonel and senior program officer at the Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention. And as always, thanks to Elizabeth Boomiller, reporter for our partner, The New York Times. They both joined us from Washington, D.C. Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So joining us now, a familiar voice. Femi, are you there?
I am. Good morning, John.
So you're not doing headlines. You're out tapping the world for stories. What's going on? What are you looking for?
Well, every week we track the unemployment figures, the numbers, but we wanted to put a face to the people who have been laid off. So this week I'm looking for people's sign-off letters when they found out that they've been laid off. Here's a lady that I'm going to meet a little bit later on today. She says, bleeping Bernie Madoff and other evil, greedy, bleeping holes like him destroying our economy, I have been eliminated. Do you have a good sign-off email or letter that you sent, or a good sign-off story? Also very interested in the boss's perspective. You can be on the air with me this week. All you have to do is call us with your sign-off for your goodbye, your laying-off letter, 1-877-8-MY-TAKE, or email your email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Great stuff, Femi. Thanks so much. We're talking about itching. Scientists now know why scratching stops an itch. Tell us your itching stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. They can be literal or figurative. And here's your takeaway.
When Obama was elected, a tribal leader from southeastern Turkey sacrificed 44 sheep in his honor with banners that says, Obama, one of us. Obviously, he's not one of us. He's the president of the United States.
44 sheep, folks, that's Asla Aydin Tashbash, journalist and former Ankara bureau chief of the newspaper Sabah, talking about Barack Obama's visit to Turkey. And you might remember us introducing this man as Richard Holbrooke at the top of the hour.
It takes time to do this. It takes time to learn it. We're anxious to share that. And we're very comprehensively moving in that direction.
That, of course, is not Richard Holbrooke, the envoy to Afghanistan. It's Admiral Mike Mullen talking about the new military strategy. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Okay, 120 mosquito bites, and you can't scratch.
I cannot begin to describe how much I want to itch this arm. Arm, I want to itch you. Oh, this is taking something else to keep me from just digging in there.
Get the fever, you get the itch.
The mysteries of that sensation that makes you crazy. You know what I'm talking about. The science of scratching what rhymes with which on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Scratch, folks. Good morning. It's Tuesday, April 7th. I'm John Hockenberry. Adora Udoji is away spending time with her new baby. Joining coming up this hour, we'll discuss a new report from the Red Cross about medical personnel who oversaw interrogations at Guantanamo Bay. And we'll also look ahead to tonight's women's basketball tournament at the NCAA. And we'll check in with the Minnesota Senate race that's still going on. Those stories coming up. First headlines. Washington in springtime. President Obama is on his way back to it. He ended his eight-day trip to Europe by asking Turkish college students to create change.
All these things are hard. I mean, I'm not naive. If it was easy, it would have already been done. Somebody else would have done it. But if we don't try, if we don't reach high, then we won't make any progress.
The president was speaking in Istanbul, and earlier today, the president met with religious leaders and toured Istanbul's famed Blue Mosque. More than 200 people are dead after an earthquake struck central Italy yesterday. Italian Premier Silvio Berlusconi says rescue efforts will continue for another 48 hours. The 6.3 quake struck the central Italian city of L'Aquila and surrounding villages, leveling entire blocks. Mark Garrison, what else you got?
Good morning, John. U.S. Special Envoy Richard Holbrooke is in Pakistan today, where he's defending the U.S. military strategy for the region. It's the first visit by American officials since the Obama administration laid out its strategy for the war in Afghanistan last month. Yesterday, Pakistani leaders told Holbrooke it needs unconditional support, the country of Pakistan does, to successfully conquer militants in its territory. A federal judge today is expected to throw out the conviction and underlying indictment of former Alaska Senator Ted Stevens. That's after a request from the Obama Justice Department. Prosecutors failed to turn over notes of a critical interview where a prosecution witness contradicted a statement he made later under oath. Stevens lost his reelection bid just days after his conviction. The Carolina Tar Heels beat the Michigan State Spartans in men's college basketball championship last night. Big time. It was 89-72. The women's championship is tonight. That pits UConn versus Louisville.
And we'll have more details about that, helping you to preview that contest. The Dow fell 0.5% yesterday to finish at 79.76. The S&P begins trading at 8:35, and the futures trading suggests a negative opening when trading begins in about a half hour. A lot of issues to talk about, but there's an issue I'm sure all of you are invested in. My cold. We turn to you a lot here on The Takeaway. We're going to ask you for some remedies.
Hello, this is Nancy Barber from Sterling Heights. My favorite cold remedy, hot lemonade. Oh, the fumes, they just go up your nose and your throat is soothed and it cuts through all that gunk you're trying to cough up.
Oh, thank you. More suggestions at 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Is my hot lemonade on the way? Please?
I see lots of lemons over there.
Thank you. Yes, I need some more lemons.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We begin this hour with the notion of what the Bush administration would have us believe about the treatment of detainees in the so-called war on terror at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, and particularly at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Here's Vice President Cheney.
We live up to our obligations and international treaties that we're party to and so forth. But the fact is, you can have a fairly robust interrogation program without torture, and we need to be able to do that.
That's right. The U.S. does not torture. Here's President Bush speaking on the subject in 2006.
This country doesn't torture. We're not going to torture. We will interrogate people we pick up off the battlefield to determine whether or not they've got information that'll be helpful to protect the country.
whatever you call it, torture or not, the details of what went on at Guantanamo and Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan have been coming out because of a 2007 report by the International Committee of the Red Cross in Geneva. The report, which was supposedly confidential, was actually obtained by journalist Mark Danner and extensively quoted in a gripping article in the New York Review of Books recently. Now the New York Times has picked up the story. Scott Shane joins us. He's a New York Times reporter speaking with us from Maryland. And also Greg Block, who's a visiting law professor at the University of Chicago, who's also trained as a medical doctor. He joins us from Chicago. First of all, good morning to you both.
Good morning.
And the particular issue, good morning. The particular issue I want to focus on here, which is the focus of your piece in today's paper, Scott Shane, is the apparent complicity of medical personnel in either controlling or enhancing, I can't tell which, the procedures, the interrogation procedures, the so-called waterboarding and other techniques that were used. Doctors were present. First of all, Scott Shane, what did you discover and how unusual are these details as you've obtained them from the ICRC report?
Well, let me correct one point. The 14 people that the ICRC investigators interviewed were the so-called high-level al-Qaeda detainees who had actually undergone these harsh interrogations, what the ICRC describes as torture, not at Guantanamo or Bagram, but for the most part in secret locations overseas. We've reported that those locations included secret bases in Thailand and Poland.
So they might have been detained ultimately at Guantanamo or Bagram, but on their way, the interrogations themselves actually took place at the black sites.
That's exactly right. In September of 06, President Bush announced that 14 people, some of whom were involved in the 9/11 attacks, had been moved to Guantanamo and for the first time acknowledged officially that the United States was holding them. But on the medical issue, this ICRC report, which is based entirely on interviews with these detainees, so there's always the possibility that there are inaccuracies, although the accounts pretty much adhere to one another. They describe medical personnel, and the prisoners, not surprisingly, weren't certain whether they were physicians or paramedics of some kind, or in some cases psychologists, had monitored the treatment that they got, everything from shackling people to the ceilings to keeping them for days on end in cold cells to keeping them up all night with loud music, and including waterboarding, where water is poured into the mouth and nose of the prisoner. All that was monitored by medical personnel who would check on them from time to time and sometimes give a signal to continue the treatment, sometimes say you have to stop or you have to change something. So their impression was that this was partly intended to prevent deaths or permanent injury, but certainly partly intended to mainly intended to keep the interrogations going.
Well, Greg Block, you were interviewed by Scott Shane for his piece. Now, the Sean Penns of the world might say that's outrageous. What a horrible thing for a doctor to do, to be a part of an interrogation. But the Sean Hannitys of the world might say, hey, what other country would torture and have a doctor there in case you get hurt? Which is it, Greg Block?
Well, other countries have, and we might not want to associate ourselves with them. South Africa under apartheid, Chile under Pinochet, the Uruguayan military dictatorship. This is a pattern, and we have seen this over the last 30 or 40 years in dictatorships that have embarked upon systematic programs of torture.
Can you imagine getting a call from the government saying, we need you to hop on a plane and go to this black site because we're going to, sort of quietly electrocute some fellow?
Well, we'd hope that doctors would say no. And oftentimes, even in Pakistan in 1979, when doctors were called upon to administer corporal punishment, the medical association said no. So doctors sometimes have said no. And to their credit, some American military doctors have said no. Our own investigations of physician involvement in some of these abuses have found some naysayers. But all you need is a few willing to go along.
Scott Shane, is there a medical practice on the subject of monitoring government interrogations like this? And is it differ in the United States than, say, you know, doctors who are taught around the world to do no harm?
Well, I think the Hippocratic Oath sort of applies around the world, and certainly it is supposed to be honored in the United States. I think, you know, in terms of judging the Americans' involvement here, it's important to consider that this was unprecedented in terms of an officially approved, authorized program, approved all the way up to the President of the United States. To my knowledge, at least, the United States had not used such methods in interrogation prior to 2002. Obviously, there were exceptions to that on the ground in Vietnam or other places, but in terms of a coordinated official policy emanating from the top, so it's hard to say that there's any precedent for this in our history.
So, Scott, you described that the ICRC report is based on the accounts of detainees. Have you managed to find any of the medical personnel who might have been present at these interrogations? And if not, what would you ask such a doctor if you were able to interview them on background or otherwise?
Well, I have managed to find a few. No one has been willing to talk. I guess the question would be, from a reporter's standpoint, would be, you know, what did this look like to you? My assumption is that they would say, if we were going to do these techniques, which is, of course, the big if, you know, would you rather have it done without any medical personnel around to prevent deaths and to prevent severe injury? And, for example, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, in his account, he's the person who's believed to have been the chief planner of the 9/11 attacks. He describes the medical people intervening several times to stop waterboarding when his oxygen level apparently got too low. And so they could probably defend themselves by saying, you know, we were trying to at least make sure people live through these interrogations.
Now, Greg Block, you are trained as a medical doctor, as a psychiatrist, right?
Yes.
Now, I don't want to, you know, rely on your expertise there, because I understand that you're a law professor at the University of Chicago right now. But at what point, and use your best guess here, does a doctor attempting to maintain life in such an interrogation setting actually become an agent for prolonging pain and suffering?
By merely stepping into the room, the doctor becomes an agent for prolonging something that is not just wantonly cruel, but a violation of international law. The doctors wouldn't be there unless the government at the highest levels was concluding that there is a risk of serious bodily harm to these individuals. So the doctors become a way by which the government justifies, attempts to justify behavior that, in fact, is grossly inappropriate. So the aura of humanity, right, becomes a cover. And so, therefore, becomes a way of facilitating the behavior.
Scott Shane, does the medical community have a consensus on what Greg Block is saying? And we'll leave it there. We've got 45 seconds.
I think there's been a big fight in the community of psychologists over this issue, whether any participation in interrogation or particularly harsh interrogation should be permitted by psychologists. I'd say that, as far as I know, the medical profession has been, while not outspoken on this issue, I think there's a fairly broad consensus that doctors should not get anywhere near this kind of treatment.
Scott Shane, New York Times reporter, and Greg Block, visiting law professor at the University of Chicago, author of the upcoming book Do No Harm, talking about the presence of doctors in interrogations that could involve torture. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. It's actually a mystery what causes and what stops an itch, but we're going to talk a little bit later about how scientists are solving that mystery. And in honor of this sort of scientific breakthrough, what's an itch in your life, figuratively or quite literally, and how do you scratch it? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And, you know, if it sounds like I'm about to cough, it's because I have a cold. I need this cold scratched. And fortunately, you guys are helping me out.
I'm so sorry that you're sick. I'm Kristen, and I'm calling from Lincoln, Rhode Island. And I was wondering how you felt about garlic. My Italian grandfather, whenever he would get a cold, he used to eat a clove of garlic every, I don't know, 3-4 hours.
All right, garlic. I'm there. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Well, if you stayed up to watch the NCAA championship in the men's game last night, you may be feeling it this morning, but you're not as miserable as the MSU Spartans.
The performance from the start that could not have been any finer. North Carolina is the 2009 national champion.
His performance could not have been finer in a spectacular walk-on to the program, The Takeaway, last week. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is a blogger, did our sort of sports setup of the NCAA finals and the Final Four. Now, you didn't exactly predict that MSU would win, but you said this is the future of basketball. What did you see last night? Welcome to the program, and then let's talk about the women's game.
Good morning, good morning, good morning. Last night, we saw the scoring machine in full action. UNC was just ridiculous. They played amazing defense. They took the ball away 8 times. Lawson was just unstoppable. And then you had just like they just didn't let up at any given moment in the game.
I mean, really, this year's March Madness is the battle of the unstoppables. Most of the top seeds made it all the way to the end. And in the women's game, there's nobody more unstoppable than the UConn women. Describe this team and just how much of a blockbuster they are.
They haven't lost. They haven't beaten any team by less than 31 points. That's the average. So they could literally go down as one of the best basketball teams in the history of basketball, particularly for the women's game. Connecticut has had 2 undefeated teams previously, so that has, you know, that's not the barrier that they're breaking. But in terms of just efficiency and just stomping on opponents, this UConn women's basketball team is ridiculous.
And they're playing a team not known for basketball, Louisville.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, they're a powerful team, but still, nobody gives them a chance.
Well, Louisville is in the Big East, which, for the Big East folks, is great, right?
Yeah.
Louisville is known for football. They're known for track. They're not known for women's basketball. So I think in many ways, this game is going to give them some major respect.
What is the style difference between the men's game and the women's game that people should watch? And does the Big East, in both the men and women's game, have a stylistic signature?
I would definitely say that actually, and you know, I've been thinking about this a lot, they actually don't have that much of a stylistic difference at this point in the game.
Right.
There's a lot of crisp passing, a lot of amazing shooting, a lot of outside shooters. A lot of these kids grew up shooting and seeing big three-pointers, and that's what they've built their game around. The crisp passing is really a big thing, and then just a really tight defense.
You're seeing a return to team play in the NCAA that really is at odds to what goes on in the NBA, where it's star-driven a lot, and you know, defense often doesn't happen until the last period.
I think exactly, you're right on point with that, and I think part of that is that you have all these players that go up early with the men's game. And I think that's the primary difference between the women's game and the men's game, is that what you have on the court are some seniors versus seniors when it gets to the women's game tournament. So these women have been working for this their entire lives.
You know, the irony, of course, is that the WNBA is struggling, while the NBA, I mean, it's not struggling. It's certainly not its high point. It makes the NCAA game better, but it doesn't enhance the professional game. Why?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think the part of the reason, and you can see in the NCAA tournament this year for with the women's, last night you had 70,000 people, 70,000 people right. watching that game. And in the women's game, there was under 20,000. So I think that what you see the parallels between the two games. And I think people just need to recognize that the women's game is really good, and they need to go see it. If you want to see a quality basketball game, you should go tonight. If you're in St. Louis, you should go tonight.
Yeah, if you think the team play for the men's game is something, watch these women play. That's really the amazing thing. All right, give me the standout names to watch tonight, UConn versus Louisville.
Well, okay, so on the Louisville side, you have Angel McCautry. She's the star. She's the figurehead of the team. They also have, I think, the woman that I'm looking to be, this is her Candace Bingham.
Right.
Candace Bingham. She's from Louisville. This is her team. She's a senior. She's the one that does the little things that no one else does. So that's the name. I think if you want to see someone who's going to come out and make it their game, it's going to be Candace Bingham.
She's the triple-double. She's the one with the assists. She's the one with the offensive boards.
Yes.
Right. How about on the UConn side?
Well, of course, you have Maya Moore. You have Renee Montgomery. You have Kalana Green. These women are serious. They're like little Kobe Bryants, little LeBron Jameses. They have focus in their eyes. They look like predators when they're on the court. I'm afraid of them.
Now, who's going to – what do you say for a strategy? I mean, does Louisville try to slow this game down and keep it from you know, becoming a double-digit lead early on? And how do you do that against this team?
This is the key. This is the ticket. The only way to beat UConn is to keep the game close. What Louisville can do is to play tough defense, force them to make outside shots, and literally keep the game close. UConn has not been in a close game. Louisville has had the toughest road to the Final Four. If they can keep it close, Louisville will win.
Wow. Well, the drama is tonight in St. Louis, the NCAA Finals for the women's game, UConn versus Louisville. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
He's a blogger who's been intently following March Madness and is our March Madness buddy here at The Takeaway. And our headline buddy is Mark Garrison, and he's got more for us.
Thanks, John. 28 minutes after the hour, President Obama is on his way back to the U.S. after ending his first overseas trip as president in Turkey. Earlier this morning, he spoke to a town hall of Turkish college students. He told them a U.S. partnership with the Muslim world should go beyond battling terrorism. And in Pakistan, Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi says there's a lack of trust between Pakistan and the U.S., particularly over America's use of missile strikes against militants on Pakistani soil. Qureshi spoke alongside two top U.S. officials, Special Envoy Richard Holbrook and Admiral Mike Mullen. Admiral Mullen says lessons from Iraq could help in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
As you know, our armed forces have been through a dramatic change in the last several years because of the counterinsurgency capabilities that we developed in Iraq. And that took us a while to both figure out and then change. And we now are, I believe, the best counterinsurgency force in the world.
This is the first visit to Pakistan by these officials since the White House announced a new plan for the war in Afghanistan, which includes new aid to neighboring Pakistan. Vermont Governor Jim Douglas has vetoed a bill that would legalize same-sex marriage in the state. The state legislature overwhelmingly passed the bill in March, and it's already lining up a vote to overturn the veto. The Vermont House of Representatives needs five more votes than it had in March, though, to secure an override. Also, new information in the federal investigation of a salmonella outbreak in a pistachio processing plant in California. The FDA says it has found traces of the bacteria in a plant owned by Seton. That's the one that was under suspicion earlier. So the FDA is saying do not eat pistachios or anything made with them until they know more. John.
Wall Street poised to bounce down when it opens in about 10 seconds. Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
So, itch, scratch. Scientists know why scratching stops an itch, but we're going to go beyond science. directly to The Simpsons to find out what itch in your life you need scratched. And if you haven't guessed it, I'm a little bit sick. I need my cold scratched. I haven't coughed on the air yet, but help cure me, won't you?
I would suggest a week in Miami on the beach with an internet radio nearby and a supply of UTIL, U-T-I-L, and that stands for You Talk, I Listen.
Oh, nice. Can we hire that guy? Oh, man. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Cold remedies or itches and scratches in your life. It's getting your tax time now. Tom Scheck joins us now. He's a reporter for Minnesota Public Radio and writer of the political blog Polynaut. He joins us from St. Paul, Minnesota. Tom, I've missed you.
But, John, how are you, man?
But in all the time that we haven't been speaking to you, the Norm Coleman, Al Franken Senate race count court battle has still been going on. Where do we stand?
Well, it's pretty much gone from leaf blowing to snow blowing to lawn mowing. We're going to be mowing our lawns here pretty much. Today, there's a three-judge panel that's going to be reviewing 387 ballots in court, and they're going to be determining, okay, which one of these ballots should be counted, and then they're going to count these ballots. And the thing here for a lot of Minnesotans is these potentially could be the last ballots counted in this long, long, long-running Senate race.
All right, now let me do some math here. Apparently, 2.9 million votes cast, right?
Yep, yep.
And at this point in the court challenge, Al Franken is 225 votes ahead of the incumbent Norm Coleman, right?
That's right.
You got 387 ballots that the court has decided can be opened and to determine whether they count or not, right?
Right. Now, they may not count all 387, right, but they're going to count a bulk of them, yes.
Now, there has to be at least 226 votes in that stack of 387 for Norm Coleman to have a chance. Is there any chance that that's the case?
His campaign attorneys pretty much say no, because they're already talking about appealing to the Minnesota Supreme Court. So for a lot of folks who thought, boy, this is going to be the end of the game, they're going to go into overtime, another overtime, the sixth overtime, and they're going to appeal to the Minnesota Supreme Court. They've already indicated that they're going to do that. They're saying that not every valid vote and not every valid ballot is being counted. Some ballots for Al Franken were counted twice. And then they also are arguing that some ballots that are missing shouldn't be counted at all. So they're actually trying to make this argument, and they're going to make it again to the Minnesota Supreme Court.
Well, here's your feisty incumbent Senator Norm Coleman addressing that very issue on Fox News.
Minnesota Supreme Court filed within 10 days and will file quicker than 10 days, I can assure you. Bottom line is I want to make sure that there's votes are counted fairly, uniformly, and we're going to push to the Minnesota Supreme Court to make that happen if we have to.
So the Coleman people don't believe that these ballots are going to be decisive, so they just want to reopen the whole thing again with the Minnesota Supreme Court?
They're going to be making the argument again to the Minnesota Supreme Court. Now, they're not going to have to reopen everything. They're just going to make some of their cases. They're going to appeal and say, you know, the three-judge panel, this panel that was appointed by the Minnesota Supreme Court, you know, didn't look at this issue, or maybe they didn't look at that issue. We're not sure. We didn't see the legal paperwork yet. But they are arguing that votes that should have been counted have not been counted, and they think at the end of the day that once those votes are counted, Norm Coleman will be the winner.
Now, my parents live there in southern Minnesota. They've been enduring this statewide crisis for the last several months, and they've gone from leaf blowing to snow blowing to watering their lawn, just like you have. Do Minnesotans view this as the workings out of democracy in a free society, or are they sick of Al Franken before he even gets to office? And it could still be Norm Coleman, I suppose.
Well, you know, it was interesting. When the recount started, a lot of folks used to ask me, who's going to win, by how much, and when's it going to end? And now all they ask me is, when's it going to end? That being said, there is a state law in process that says, okay, if someone has a quibble with the recount, what can be done is there can be an election contest, and then there could be an appeal to the Minnesota Supreme Court. Minnesotans are pretty patient with that, but I think their patience is starting to run thin, and then when this Supreme Court ruling comes out, that's when you're going to start to see a lot of frustrated people saying, okay, now this is becoming way more political. Republicans are trying to hold this up, and we want to just see a senator be seated, because they are arguing that, you know, there is a government to be run here.
Now, because the Senate term is 6 years, in many ways there's an incentive to continue this. If it was just 2 years, you'd take such a political hit for pursuing this that you wouldn't really want to. There's no way that either side backs off.
No, and they've pretty much indicated. So the Republicans have said, hey, you know, we don't mind if Norm keeps appealing this on the federal level because this seat could be open for years. And they're saying it because when you think about it, there's one fewer vote for President Obama's policies. There's one fewer vote for Democrats to get closer to a filibuster. So if they look at it and say, well, we'll give Norm Coleman another $1 million or so to keep fighting his legal fight in Minnesota and potentially even appeal to the federal on the federal level and to the U.S. Supreme Court, you know, it's one of those things that's like, okay, well, it's money well spent because we're going to be able to, right, to slow the process down.
No end in sight. Let me just get one last question here about what the Supreme Court could do. I mean, it seems to me on one level, this is sort of a giant mess, and the Supreme Court would just say, you know what, we're not going to open this up. But on the other hand, do they have any discretion to say, all right, we're going to do a special election. Let's do a do-over. Can they invent some scenario here?
Well, they could invent it, but it's not in state law, and that's one of the things that Norm Coleman has suggested. Well, maybe we should just have another election, so to speak. And what the thing is that there's nothing in law to trigger that. So if they did say, let's have another special election, Norm Coleman may not be the person on the ballot because Republicans could then file and say, okay, well, we're gonna run in this race. We're gonna challenge Norm Coleman. Then there would be a primary. Then there could be, you know, another general election. Independence Party candidates could be in it. Third party candidates could be in it. So it could be, if they decide to do that, it would open it up for another big time election.
You know, you got to wonder if Al Franken's picked out his Senate license plates, though, anticipating some kind of victory here. Tom Scheck, thanks so much for running down the details. Tom is a reporter for Minnesota Public Radio, writer of the political blog Polynut. He joined us from St. Paul. And now Mark Garrison has some more headlines.
Thanks, John. 21 minutes before the hour, an Iraqi court has cut the sentence for the journalist who threw his shoes at former President George W. Bush. Muntadhar al-Zaidi now faces just 1 year. The court gave him a 3-year sentence last month. Today, the court said his lack of criminal history led to the lighter sentence. The death toll continues to rise after an earthquake rocked part of central Italy yesterday. At least 200 are dead and more than 1,000 injured, many seriously. Rescue workers have already pulled 100 people alive from the wreckage, but a massive aftershock sent emergency workers running from a collapsed dormitory this morning. Officials say they will continue to search for people trapped in the rubble for another 48 hours. Cuban President Raul Castro met with 6 visiting members of the Congressional Black Caucus yesterday. The meeting lasted more than 4 hours. This was President Castro's first face-to-face meeting with U.S. leaders since he took over the presidency last year. The U.S. delegation came to talk about U.S.-Cuban relations, all this as talk in Washington grows about possibly easing restrictions on Cuban travel and trade. And a new report criticizes doctors who worked with interrogations of U.S. prisoners who came through Guantanamo Bay. The International Committee of the Red Cross says some doctors violated medical ethics, put the interrogation process ahead of patient health. The Red Cross interviewed the prisoners who were allegedly waterboarded and subjected to other advanced interrogation techniques. The new information comes from a long secret report recently obtained by the New York Review of Books. John.
It's a 2007 report.
We yes, some that we were just now seeing. Yeah.
Mark Garrison, thanks so much.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Joining us here on the program is Diana Henriquez of The New York Times, one of my favorite bylines, and talking not about the widening ripple of losses from the Bernard Madoff scandal, but in fact a widening ripple of possible legal liability of individuals who worked with Madoff who are liable for different reasons and various reasons for some of those losses. Diana, first of all, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here, John.
And explain the case that appears to be against J. Ezra Merkin, who's a financier who worked with Madoff but isn't exactly implicated in the fraud. Nevertheless, he's a little bit at ground zero this morning.
He is. And actually, the intriguing thing about the case against Mr. Merkin is this new concept, as you pointed out, John, that it opens up in the developing case, which is that these feeder funds, Mr. Merkin's was not the largest, but it was one of the big ones through which investors' money wound up with Mr. Madoff. At the beginning of this dramatic story, they were at the top of the victim list. You know, they were the billion-dollar losers, $2.5 billion in Mr. Merkin's case in terms of his clients' losses. $7 billion in the case of the Fairfield Greenwich Group, which was sued by Massachusetts regulators last week. But these cases are starting to shift that protective shield away from these feeder funds, that status of being a victim of Mr. Madoff. In the Merkin case, is clearly balanced against how much he got in fees, a rather remarkable $470 million.
Wow. Well, let's supply some details here. Feeder funds actually solicit small depositors, and the feeder funds themselves participated in the Madoff funds because Madoff's cost of entry, you had to be a big player to get in with Madoff. So the feeder funds aggregated smaller depositors, and it's the smaller depositors that are going after the feeder fund here, in this case, Mr. Merkin.
Correct. Well, in the Mr. Merkin's case, he's been sued by several of his clients, his investment clients, whose money wound up with Mr. Madoff. They say they didn't know that he was steering, simply handing their money on to Mr. Madoff. And the Attorney General's lawsuit that was filed yesterday affirms that. In the fine print, you'll see that the Attorney General's office says that they interviewed more than half of Mr. Merkin's investors, and that 85% of those they interviewed had no idea that their money was being handed over to Mr. Madoff. They thought Mr. Merkin was managing it.
Is it fair to say that the Attorney General claims that Merkin acted more like a sales agent for Bernie Madoff and was positioning himself to the depositors as more like a fund manager, and that that is potentially a kind of fraud?
That is exactly the nut of the suit. They're saying he held himself out as the man managing their money, when in fact what he was doing was raising money and letting someone else, in this dreadful case, Mr. Madoff, although he'd done in the past, he'd had other people manage the money behind that magic curtain. In this case, it was Mr. Madoff, and that the volume of money he got and handed over to Bernie Madoff affected the volume of the fees that he personally collected.
Well, it sounds a little financially arcane, but it could have precedence for all kinds of managers who feed money to mutual funds, even far outside of the Madoff scandal, depending on how this goes, but it's just getting started. Diana Henriquez, thanks so much for joining us.
Happy to be here, John. Thanks.
Diana Henriquez, of course, a writer for our partner, The New York Times.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Let's get you up to date. Markets open on Wall Street, trending downward as expected, but unexpectedly, a very big story. Mark Garrison has it with the headlines.
You bet. President Obama was on the way back to the U.S., but he made an unscheduled stop. He is to Iraq. He was, of course, coming back from Turkey. Many of the press with him. The official White House schedule didn't have it for security reasons, but he did. He has made a stop into Iraq, and then coming back later tonight.
He's expected to speak with Iraqi leaders and also spend some time with the troops.
You bet. That is the plan. Earlier, he was in Istanbul. He talked to students in Istanbul today. The dialogue between the West and the Muslim world came up. Also visited with religious leaders in Turkey today. A man authorities say stole a plane in Canada and flew into the U.S. says he was trying to commit suicide. He told the Missouri trooper who arrested him that he hoped to be shot down by fighter planes. F-16 fighter jets intercepted the plane, which flew erratically and didn't respond to questions. It ultimately landed in Missouri. John.
Thank you, Mark. So imagine you have about 100 little mosquito bites on your arm, and you're just looking at it and you're feeling, oh my God, I really want to.
I cannot begin to describe how much I want to itch this arm. I want to itch you. Oh, this is taking something else to keep me from just digging in there.
Go ahead, dude. Scratch. Why does a scratch work? Why does an itch make your nerves do things no other sensation does? Of course, the sensation is very familiar to everyone. We all know what an itch is. We know what a scratch is. But we don't know how they come about. Glenn Geisler joins us. He's a neuroscience professor at the University of Minnesota. Glenn, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. Happy to be here.
Yeah, you are talking to us about recently published science that begins to explain the very familiar itch in terms of some science that's actually been mysterious for quite a long time. Number one, what is an itch, neurologically speaking?
Well, itch is defined and has been as an unpleasant sensation that makes us want to scratch. So it's a very simple definition, and I think we'd all see the utility of that. Several groups have started looking at how information begins in the peripheral nervous system and peripheral nerves and how the information is coded there and then brought into the spinal cord. And we're looking at the information, how it's transmitted within the spinal cord and sent from the spinal cord to the brain and ultimately to consciousness.
Now, itches are very, very tangible. I mean, people have a sense that there's something under their skin wandering around. In the case of something like Hodgkin's disease, itching is a very, very serious symptom that is incredibly debilitating. The tangibility of the itch sensation is actually at odds with what's going on with the neurons, correct?
Well, itch is a distinct sensation, and it causes a strong urge to scratch. And what we found is that the neurons in the central nervous system and others have found in the peripheral nervous system, including a group at Johns Hopkins led by Matthias Ringkamp, have found that actually many of the nerves in the peripheral nerves carry information both about pain and itch. And we found the same thing in the neurons in the spinal cord that convey this information to the brain and consciousness, also carry information about pain. So it's kind of a multiplex system carrying at least two types of information, probably about temperature. But even though these same nerves are carrying several types of information, it is a very distinct sensation. And in the disease you mentioned, Hodgkin's disease and other diseases, AIDS and many others, probably more than 50, it's often very difficult to treat. There are some problems, infestations, mosquito bites, as you mentioned in the lead-in, release histamine in the skin. And so taking antihistamines like Benadryl can be very helpful in relieving the itch.
Now, what's the difference between an itch that actually is happening on your skin, like a mosquito bite, and something that may be more generalized? Say your hand gets really, really cold and gets numb, and as it comes back from being asleep, there's an itching sensation that actually there's no evidence on the skin of anything going on.
It's hard to answer so many questions about itch. It's undoubtedly the least well-understood sensation. There are hundreds of, for example, from the National Institutes of Health, hundreds of grants to support research on vision and hearing and pain, but there are at the moment four to support research on itch, and so the progress has been very, very slow. So we don't really know how these diseases cause itch body-wide. Itch. We know it can be a huge problem that's very difficult to treat. And one example that is, I think, very a sad example is that people who are in terminal cancer pain often have to take a lot of morphine or its derivatives, opiates, and they have to take so much to combat the pain that the morphine starts producing itch. And this can't be treated, and so many of the patients elect to take less morphine, endure more chronic, intractable pain to relieve the itch. So this is a huge problem.
Why does a scratch work insofar as it does? And there's plenty of evidence that certain scratches are actually wrong or a bad idea.
Right. But certainly scratching is thought to be part of, a vestige of grooming behavior and relieving infestations on the skin, etc. So part of scratching is useful. With the diseases, we see no clear purpose for scratching, and it can be quite destructive. We've begun to look at how scratching inhibits itch. We all know from personal experience that it's effective, and we've known for, since people began that scratching and animals as well relieves itch. But when we began a few years ago, we looked at neurons in the spinal cord and found neurons that carry the information about itch. And so we turned back to those to look at the effects of scratching on those as a logical place to begin. And lo and behold, what we found is that when we scratch the skin before we cause itch, and in this case, we were causing itch by injecting histamine into the skin, so kind of mirroring the effect of, for example, a mosquito bite that releases histamine in the skin. We were injecting it since applying mosquitoes is a tricky stimulus.
Right.
We injected the histamine. And what we found is when we scratched the skin before we injected the histamine, the scratch excited the neurons. These neurons carry information about pain, as I said, and scratching is a form of painful stimulation. In fact, we scratch, our hands are available and our fingernails, but other kinds of painful stimuli inhibit itch just as well. It could be a very hot stimulus, a very cold stimulus. Even injection of the active ingredient in chili peppers, capsaicin, can block itch.
Huh.
So we found that it was excitatory. And we also found that if we injected capsaicin, this pain agent, if we inject it into the skin, which I don't recommend, then that produces pain, and that excites these neurons too. And when we scratched during these responses, the responses were heightened. But when we injected histamine and the cells were responding to that, the same stimulus, the identical stimulus, scratch, caused the neurons to fire less. It inhibited them, and it inhibited them for about the same period of time that scratching relieves itch.
Hmm.
So we think then that we scratch really to turn off these neurons in the spinal cord.
Finally, is it easy to find itchy and scratchy people there at the University of Minnesota to come into your experimental lab?
Well, we do experiments on animals. We do animal research. My colleague at Yale, Robert Lamott, does a lot of experiments on people, but he induces the itch with histamine and other agents. There are good
How much do you pay to make somebody miserable for a couple hours?
I'm not really sure. I would think $50 or so would do it.
Sure.
These are undergraduates who can use some spending money.
I love it. Oh, very responsible scientist there. Well, it's great science. It's an interesting sort of use of experimental method to discover something that I actually didn't even realize was a mystery. Glenn Giesler, thanks for joining us.
You're quite welcome.
The Science of Itching and Scratching. Glenn Giesler is a neuroscience professor at the University of Minnesota. He joined us from St. Paul. So we're always on at the Takeaway. We are following a story this morning, unexpected, broke just about 15, 20 minutes ago. Barack Obama has made a surprise trip to Iraq after his visit to Turkey, and it caps his first overseas trip as president with a stop in the war zone. The president landed in Baghdad in the evening after spending time in Istanbul. All the details on this story on this public radio station later on today. And hey, who needs a doctor when I have you? I have a cold and you've got some remedies.
Hey, John. This is Kevin from Brooklyn. Some homeopathic remedies do help. They're not a cure-all, but they do help. Golden Seal is an old Indian remedy. It will help speed the recovery of your cold. Does not taste good, but it works.
And I have some alternatives here.
That Thai soup. Tom Yum Kun with all the spices and shrimp. Hot showers, steamy, and you'll get better fast.
Oh, man, I'm feeling better already. And one more idea?
Hey, this is Dale Davidson from New York City. If you are stopped up in your nose, you might try sucking some salt water through it and spitting it out again. Yeah, kind of icky, but you get used to it.
You know, thanks for all those remedies. Now, this doesn't mean that you don't have to pledge when there's a pledge drive. All right, if you missed anything, take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or iTunes. One more thing. Scratch that itch. It's The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.